Welcome to the eLaborate Topics podcast, where we focus on lab-specific strategies for medical laboratory professionals. We're proud to be the healthcare detectives that work behind the scenes to get the results needed to influence medical decisions. Let's grow together and jump right into the lab.
Welcome to eLaborate Topics podcast. eLaborate Topics podcast is a weekly podcast where we bring you tools and guests to help you to excel in your laboratory journey. And today is no other. We have some amazing guests. And eLaborate Topics podcast, we have myself and my co-host, Tywana Wilson and Stephanie Whitehead. Today we'll have just myself and Stephanie interviewing some amazing guests. And joining us in our studio, these two distinguished guests are really the forefront of the editorial leadership in the lab. And they're from Today's Clinical Lab and G2 Intelligence. We have Miriam Bergeret and Scott Wallace. They've been really instrumental in delivering more content on medical lab professional. They inform us a lot in things that are evolving in the lab industry. And their expertise really span across a lot of topics from cutting edge technologies to latest trends in research. So welcome, Miriam, and welcome, Scott, to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting us.
Thanks so much for having us.
Awesome. I'm going to just give a quick bio for both Miriam and Scott. So Scott Wallace is a senior editorial manager for Today's Clinical Lab and G2 Intelligence. He has spent more than 25 years covering the healthcare and high-tech industries. A former newspaper reporter, he graduated from Northeastern University with a degree in journalism. And Miriam Bergeret is Today's Clinical Lab's managing editor. So before joining Today's Clinical Lab, Miriam obtained her Master of Science in Laboratory Medicine and Pathobiology from the University of Toronto and gained valuable laboratory experience as flow cytometry cell sorting specialist as a career research center in Toronto, Canada. She went on to study publishing at Toronto Metropolitan University and is an active member of Editors Canada and the Council of Science Editors. I want to welcome you again to our show, Miriam and Scott.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
So Miriam and Scott, this is Stephanie, and I'm pretty familiar with both of your platforms, but for any of our listeners that have been under a LinkedIn rock and have not been aware of either of your platforms, why don't you take a moment to tell us about the platforms that you both are editors for, the reach, the audience it serves, and maybe even how it's transformed over the different years. And so I'll start with Today's Clinical Lab and you, Miriam, and then we'll move on to you, Scott, with G2 Intelligence.
Yeah, thanks so much, Stephanie. So Today's Clinical Lab, we're an online and digital publication, and we're mostly focusing on the lab space in the US. So our origin story is we're kind of a clinical lab spinoff from Lab Manager magazine, but we rebranded in 2022 to become our own entity. So we try to focus on kind of those core topics of leadership and management, sort of where we came from, but we've also been expanding a lot into management, education, training, and also hitting those kind of big topics right now, especially since the pandemic, trying to create more content around things like burnout, mental health, well-being in the lab. We're really happy to still be active in the community. We've been able to get back to conferences recently, last year, which was so great to finally meet a lot of you in person. And I'm really looking forward to conference season this year. So yeah, I'll let Scott talk about D2 a little bit.
Okay, yeah, thank you. G2 kind of has its roots way back in the early 2000s. So anyone who had been kind of following some of the lab compliance stuff in the US may be familiar with some of their publications from, National Lab Reporter was an old one way back when. It went through a series of acquisitions, ended up at our parent company, and now the flagship publication we put out from it is called the Lab Industry Advisor. And I think what separates it from today's clinical lab are two main areas. One, G2 is a subscriber product, so people are paying to read it, much like a daily newspaper type of setup. The other thing that to me differentiates them from my end on the editorial is G2 really focuses heavily on US regulatory stuff, such as Medicare compliance or billing and coding. Needs. So from that end, it aims pretty squarely at lab directors who are running some of the day-to-day business and have to worry about that type of thing in terms of running, making sure that they're staying ahead of the rules of the government and not getting into trouble with, the Department of Justice or OIG opinions and stuff like that. So those are the big differences there in terms of what our focus has been on. A lot of it in recent memory is, looking a lot at how some of the COVID policies that labs have had to come up with are now kind of coming up against some of the regulatory issues in terms of Medicare compliance and things that maybe weren't looked at as heavily during the public health emergency but now the government is looking a little more heavily into in terms of how did you get this reimbursement, and why it, why did you submit it this way? I think there's a lot more eyes on that now than there was during the pandemic.
Awesome. I like the compliment. So today's clinical lab will, I see it almost like the soft side and the hard side. So a lot of people need to know the regulatory part, need to know what's changing in our industry. And also they want to know some of the things that are going to help us as professionals. So with a lot of the reviews that you have done in terms of the editorial, what are some of those hot topics right now that's really relevant that either you have seen recently or you have seen over the years that's really relevant to us as medical lab professionals to kind of give them that little taste so they can come searching for a lot of these topics that's going to be helpful. Maybe Miriam could start.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, over the last several years, there's been a lot of focus on shortages, so staff shortages, cuts in reimbursement, and sort of the human side of that, what it means for lab workers, how can managers do more with less? How can they advocate, to their hospital leadership, for example? So we focused a lot on providing tools and resources to the audience. So kind of like I guess that soft side you said. So perhaps in the clinical training programs, you're really getting that scientific side of the education. And we're trying to sort of fill in the other part of the job, right? So yeah, we've had a chance to talk to like see new advocacy groups, right? Grassroots organizations rise up. It's been a privilege to talk to them, get to interview them, and help them like spread their message. So, that's one aspect of it. And in the last few months, we've been focusing a lot on lab developed tests and proposed changes from the FDA. I think when I first joined today's clinical lab in 2020, this was one of the main issues that I learned about as a Canadian. And so it's been a story that we've been following closely, just trying to get, the best and most accurate and timely information out to people. But yeah, I think lab automation too has been a large discussion this year. And Scott was recently at SLAS, and yeah, how was that conference for you, Scott?
Yeah, that was it was yeah, I don't know in terms of people who are listening, how many people have been to that conference or not before. It goes beyond the diagnostic labs, but there's a good slice of it that does deal with clinical laboratory automation. And for me, it was aside from, kind of just being wowed by some of the technology that's at work there, with automation. I think the thing that struck me that came up a few times that, we've talked about and I've written a little bit about is kind of this underlying issue of trust in automation, not only from the technology itself of, what's it going to do to my staff or what's it going to do in my day-to-day, but also kind of a generational thing going on with it that, who will use it, how will they use it, and what they'll get out of it if they do adopt it, all seem to be areas in terms of automation that a lot of people are interested in. I think the other big topic for me that's fascinated me for a while and continues to do so is just how much data plays a part in potentially the success or failure of a lab as a business or business unit. And that it seems like the savvy labs that are able to grasp onto some way to monetize that data are probably putting themselves ahead of their competitors in the community and being able to recognize that opportunity and figure out, what kind of data do we have? How do we analyze it? Who's a champion on the lab team that knows about this? And who's able to talk to maybe people in the business analytics department of a hospital, for example, or an IT department about, can we get some of your resources to use this data more? I think those are really kind of the interesting stories that are kind of behind the scenes for labs these days, that don't necessarily involve adding a test panel as a way to increase revenue.
I know Stephanie have a question, but I think just listening to you, Scott, there's a lot that we take for some, maybe I take for granted, especially when it comes to automation, because there are some hospitals or labs that's been automated forever, and then some people are just getting on. And then there's AI, where you talk about trust. And then you spoke about data, and I could see that just having a lot of that information, you, in an editorial sense, already have so much data based on the information that's coming to you, and you can use that to predict. And so, with you saying that using data and even selling data could be a business, I see you guys in a really great position. Just getting the information and looking at the trend and being able to predict and even help the lab to move in maybe a direction that they need to go. So I just love that. That I just got that kind of observation, and I just thought I would just, comment on that. But I find that very interesting.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I think we've seen some really awesome superstars in our lab community start to emerge, talking around and really using their expertise around AI and lab data and LIS and how you can use data to really tell that story. And that's really going to be an important piece moving into the future for labs visibility and advocacy. So I really totally agree. Miriam, when you were answering, you made me think of something because you were talking about trying to stay up to date with the rapidly changing kind of landscape of laboratory medicine. And so I have a question for you. What are some of the challenges that today's clinical lab does experience when it comes to staying up to date with the latest content? Do you have a way within your organization to really farm those things out? Because things like LDTs, automation, the FDA ruling, those things kind of change quickly. And so do you have mechanisms to really quickly pivot and help our community stay up to date in some of those changes?
Yeah, part of our mission is really to be a platform and really try to center experts in the field as the main voice. So It is a challenge to stay up to date in terms of we're not in the labs, right? We're not on the ground facing the day-to-day challenges. So we're really relying on people being open and sharing their real experiences with us. And then equally with experts sharing their insights and opinions, through our articles and our blog and also our webinars. So I think that is, I guess, our main strategy is going out there and finding people who want to advocate, who want to speak out and want to share their insights. And yeah, we're always looking for new voices, people who want to share.
Well, is that the same for you too, also, Scott, with G2 Intelligence? How does your platform find those new and breaking stories and really focus on getting that up-to-date content out?
Yeah, some of it is a struggle at times in terms of because, you've got the internet, you've got people on their phones. They can, if you were following LDTs and that was one of your things you like to follow, you could, follow that news on your own straight from the FDA and read it through, and kind of be your own news source. And I think, we've kind of realized that, and I think a lot of business publishers have realized that trying to break news these days is really hard when you're using a website and you're going, posting at whatever intervals you're posting at. So I think for me, I've seen more of a trend towards, not trying to necessarily break the news, but trying to report on it and analyze it in a way and bring the value through the analysis of it in terms of, what does this mean for the lab? What does a lab director or a bench worker need to know about this rule or regulation or whatever topic we're writing about? That's the type of stuff that's, often missing from kind of the general reporting on stuff you see. And I think we can bring that both from, my background in journalism. I can bring that aspect to it. Miriam could bring the aspect of doing journalism with a science background to it as well. So I think that's a nice complement for us in that sense. But yeah, I think also just trying to understand what worries people out there in the industry helps me to decide how to report something, and maybe give it a different hook to it that, helps us differentiate ourselves from our competitors. So I think that's also part of the game too, is not only how do you get the news out, how do you do it, but how do you do it in a different way?
And I know both of you have a very extensive background in journalism. And Miriam, in your bio, Lori, Lona read that you are still an active member of the Editorials of Canada. And so, what do you think are some of the biggest challenges that are facing just your arena of journalism right now? Starting with either one of you.
Oof. Well, if you're paying attention to the news, it's a bit of a tough time for the media. There's been a lot of layoffs. A lot of news organizations have been cutting staffing costs recently. But just in general, one of the growing trends has, in a way, been connected to the science issue around misinformation and disinformation, which is like fewer people fact checking available for fact checking staff or fact checking. So, especially as we're going into an election year, sorry to mention politics, but it is something that is always in the back of our mind. So, sorry, I forgot where I was going with that one. But yeah, misinformation and disinformation is definitely a big issue that we've encountered, especially online. So, like you've seen that during the pandemic, it's great to see all the online communities and discussions that have been started. Collaborations and scientific collaborations have come out of it. And for us, it's great to be able to actually go into those discussions online with people. But from our point of view, we're always striving to fact check, to use, primary peer-reviewed research, make sure that the sources that we're using are credible so we can provide the best content for our readers.
Awesome.
I think for me, and I'll say it quickly, in terms of journalism, whether it's science journalism or generally, I think AI is a big concern, not only from the reality of, you know, does it threaten a traditional publishing company if software can create a lot of this writing on its own and doesn't need a human to do it, in terms of like aggregating stuff or what have you. But also, I think in even a bigger picture, I think any publishing company needs to figure out how it's going to use AI, because if you don't use it, you're going to get left behind. I think it's going to be a tool, just like many other things that people have, that people will use to help them research or you know, I know in some cases we've even used it to run different headlines and just see which ones come up if they're better than what we've had. So I think the sooner that any, you know, media company can get its hands around that and get a policy and try to figure out what's a fair use of it, what's an open, transparent use of it that readers can understand, I think that's probably best for everyone, because it's going to be, I think AI will be in everyone's job at some point. And I think, you know, I've got kids in high school, I think by the time they're in the workforce, it's just going to be another tool people use.
Totally agree. And your profession is not like unlike laboratory medicine, because we hear that in our arenas too, that people wonder how AI and machine learning and all of these things are going to threaten laboratory jobs in the future. So it's interesting to know that that's something that's not singular to one profession, but we're all kind of wondering how this is either going to help or aid and how we're going to use it in the future. So,
yes. So I like a lot of what you just said. Something you said in terms of the challenge that was, yes, everybody have access to the information, but you did say it depends. There are two things that I brought up, the way it's synthesized. And another thing that was brought up is, Marianne said, fact checks to stand out. And then I started thinking about a lot of us who go on social media. We have a lot of these discussions. You know, we try to advocate for the profession. And then there is today's clinical lab that, you know, you have published a lot of important information like LDT and so on. I am more seeing it as like, how can we change the way we do things without being redundant or people are not interested anymore because they already have the information. So with Miriam using fact checking and being part of this whole discussion and whole synthesizing the information in a way that everyone can understand and make sense of it, there's a lot of us that's going on and we're advocating and we're using social media as a platform. How do you see yourself and how do you even see others in terms of that benefit of using social media, using journalism to really advocate for our profession? How can we kind of come together and make it really valuable?
God, do you want to start with this one?
Yeah,
Scott, sure. You want to start it? Because sure. I kind of heard that trend. He was talking about moving away from the traditional way of journalism. And, you know, how do you see us using social media and journalism combining?
It's an interesting topic that you bring up there. You know, I look to something like LinkedIn, for example, and, you know, I get a fair amount of news from LinkedIn just going through my feed there. And I think that platform has some benefits in terms of social media, because it's at least touted as a professional platform. You tend to see the discussions are a little more solidly in the, you know, how does this whatever issue affecting my job or, you know, stuff like that. So I think that could be an effective way to talk to people through there. And, you know, people will read long form content on there. You know, I've been at past jobs where the debate has been, you know, do we put something up on LinkedIn and see, you know, do we put it up there and gain more viewers, even though they aren't coming to our own site? So you don't get the benefit of, you know, page views and metrics like that you would look at on your own website and your own domain, but do you reach broader audience by going to another website, in this case LinkedIn, and trying it that way as a way to reach out to people. So I think that can be it's kind of a double-edged sword for a lot of publishing companies to do it like that, because they want those metrics of people coming on their site, because a lot of advertising is based on that. But in terms of reach, LinkedIn's pretty far-reaching. I think we've got to be careful on certain social media sites. I think, you know, X, Twitter, has turned into a problem in terms of, I think it doesn't seem to matter what topic you're talking about on Twitter, it turns into an argument that very rapidly goes beyond what the original topic ever was. I know I've tended to stray away from that. I used to be fairly active on Twitter back in the day, and I found a lot of healthcare people were active on it as well. But now I think it's tough to be on there and have to tiptoe around all the time on it. So I've tended to get away from it. I think I'm also intrigued. I don't know if I've ever been able to convince, you know, someone at a publishing company who tends to be older, you know, people who have been around a while who tend to run the ship. I've never been able to convince anyone that something like TikTok might be a way to go. But I'm definitely interested in watching how other news organizations use TikTok to spread to spread their own message to get information out to people of younger crowds, and how video works into that. I think that's another area would be cool to explore, but we haven't got there yet.
I can guide you.
I'm in. We should talk after.
If I could add like a specific example, I think when CMS wanted to recognize nurses for high complexity testing, that's something that really activated the community. You have the advocates going on social media platforms, people were speaking out, opposing it, organizations were releasing statements, but people were also giving media interviews, going on podcasts and talking about it. So I think that that's one way that social media has really benefited lab advocates, and of course recently they have reversed that suggestion, so it seems like a little bit of a success there. We're excited to see that. I've seen a lot of Instagram accounts of people just trying to make the lab fun, doing catwalks, dances in labs, and trying to get younger people interested in the profession and aware of it, because we've ran a lot of articles about outreach, especially in high schools, because people just don't know about this profession. It's nice to see those things happening and to also participate and help support them.
Well, one thing you mentioned is something that we all talk about and we've been talking about for decades, is that people just don't know about our profession. Both of you kind of mentioned things that were really prevalent and relevant to that, which is, many of us, if you have social media, you have a platform, you have a way to be visible, you have a way to be advocates. Now that can go awry and left sometimes if you are in some of those rooms or in some of those conversations on X that Scott was talking about, or that can go in our favor if you are using it in the way that Miriam just talked about in her example with the CMS ruling with the nursing. So I have a question for both of you, just knowing the power of a personal platform and knowing that, our voices individually build to a huge collective voice, especially when it comes to advocacy and, outreach and reaching the younger generations and helping them understand what we do and introducing them to STEM. Our audience oftentimes like to hear practical things from our podcast. And so we pride ourselves on being a podcast that gives people things they can walk away from and click their pen and write down a tip or two that they can walk away from. So I'm going to start with Scott, but ask you, if you're listening right now, what's one thing from Scott Wallace that you think our listeners should stop doing and start doing? And then we'll go to Miriam also, but I'm interested to hear your advice to our audience.
And would this be just for in terms of advocacy or just in general?
In general, let's keep it broad. Make it easy on you.
Okay. I think in terms of what they should start doing, I I've always been a big believer that you need to, trumpet your own success to the bosses higher up, particularly if you're owned by a parent organization or a health system or something like that. I think the pandemic helped labs do that for a period of time where they were able to very clearly show this is our value we bring. And then I think, once the pandemic and the public health emergency ended, it seemed like things tended to shift back to the way they were. I think, I would imagine most lab directors don't spend a lot of their day-to-day thinking, how do I paint this picture to an executive of what we do so that they understand the work that's involved here and the revenue that's involved here. And I think if you can find people of like minds and other departments who are having the same challenges and can kind of collectively bring those efforts together into some sort of group or committee, and then approach executives as a group, I think people would tend to respond to that higher up the chain more in terms of we need more resources, here's why, and here's the different departments it affects, or we need more staff, and here's how it's going to help these other departments. I think that's something that I think would help labs kind of shake off that feeling that we're, left alone here to fend for ourselves with our reimbursement and our staff cuts and stuff like that, and maybe make them part of a bigger push within a parent organization to show the value of some of these departments that are that don't get the spotlight all the time. But I think that would be one thing I would encourage labs in general to do. In terms of not doing anymore, that's an interesting question. I am not a clinician, so I can't necessarily speak to clinical stuff that, has fallen by the wayside or that people shouldn't be doing anymore. I think from a business perspective, I think one of the things that I learned when I went to a few years ago, I went to work for a software company. I hadn't worked at a software company before, and quickly realized that I was pushing the age curve there in terms of being, I may have been the oldest person in the marketing department. At that point, I was in my late 40s. So there's a lot of younger workers there. And I looked at what they were doing and how they were doing it and started to draw just some inspiration, and not only just how I did my work, but also how I thought about things a little bit. So I think I would encourage, people in labs to, if they've got a younger crew in there, to lean into that a little more and just not just push the tasks that, a rookie would get in the lab and let them do that, but also think, how are they communicating? I think that's a really interesting thing. How are people talking to each other? And you can learn a lot there. And, that might help market the lab's services better in a community if you know how people are communicating on the younger end of things. So I think that, seeing people kind of embrace the people who are coming into the profession, not just as, it's another warm body and we need this in the lab, but also just how are these people living life and talking to each other and getting ideas around? I think, if labs could do that instead of kind of saying, well, that's just the young staff coming in, I don't need to worry about that because I'm the lab director. I think that would be a thing, not to do, and instead try to embrace that a little stronger.
Yeah, that's that inclusivity piece. And I think we've all kind of talked about that on, I think I've talked about on, that on y'all's platform, but that's
Yes.
something that's that's big, that's going to be important for our retention. And I'm going to give myself credit for a journalist calling my question interesting. So I think I've made it in life now. Miriam, what about you?
I'll add that outside of sort of advocating for yourself, maybe upwards, right? Also, collaboration can be useful. So we've had discussions at conferences and articles also at today's clinical lab around collaboration with allied professionals. So sort of actually, meeting them face to face, having regular rounds with them, bringing them into the lab to show them, like, this is what we do. This is how you get your test result for your patient. And trying to build more bridges so that you're actually creating advocates for you, right? Because it can get tiring to be doing all of that yourself. So really trying to build some allyship within your organization has been, what I hear from readers, a really effective approach. So That's one thing I would recommend. And then, getting involved outside of the lab. So it kind of just goes a little bit back to the conversation around outreach, but also getting involved in professional organizations, committees, and their initiatives around governments, and policies. So we're participating in the Lab Manager Leadership Summit this year. We have some events, and one of our speakers is going to be the CEO of the Medical Laboratory Professionals Association of Ontario. And so, Ontario is a province in Canada, and it's probably not on your guys's radar, but during the pandemic, they really kind of stepped up and were able to become a national voice for lab medicine in Canada to advocate to governments for more funding, and more training programs, bringing in more people. And so she's going to be the CEO is going to be there. She's going to be giving our keynote, and sharing some practical strategies that they used. So I know the legal and government landscape is different in the US. But yeah, it's getting involved outside the lab, I would say, is key, because not only are you helping amplify voices together, but yeah, you're providing yourself with something active to do with your frustrations in a way to make sure that you're getting heard.
Awesome. And you're kind of touching where I'm, as I close, I just want to have you expand on your upcoming events that's coming on. And just FYI, we actually had your keynote as a guest on Elaborate Topics. So we'll be promoting once we publish that episode. So kudos there. So tell the guests as we close, what are some of the upcoming events that they should be looking out for from today's clinical lab and G2?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, today's clinical lab is going to be participating at the 2024 Lab Manager Leadership Summit in Denver, Colorado. It's April 29th to May 1st, which I know kind of overlaps with Knowledge Lab, but the clinical events are going to be the first day, April 29th. So we're still hoping people can fly out and join us. So we'll have a full day events with Michelle Hoad, as you mentioned, the clinical speaker. And then we will also have a clinical discussion panel, which was really great last year. People came out, asked questions, they shared their practical insights and strategies, commiserated. So it was a great discussion, and we're hoping that even more people will join us this year. And then, of course, you, Lana, Stephanie, and Taiwana as well will be hosting a workshop for leaders. So yeah, we're really excited about that event. And we also have a digital event coming up, which is centered around women in leadership. So we'll be talking about, I guess, some of those more soft topics that you mentioned. So there'll be a talk on imposter syndrome, one around burnout in the lab, and well, like what you can do for yourself, but also for yourself. And yeah, it'll be a great event.
I think the nice
Awesome.
thing about both of those events is that they do kind of get at different topics. And we were talking about the clinical kind of harder topics versus the softer topics. I think what you'll see in person at the summit is definitely some of the harder edged topics that the clinicians will relate to. Whereas Miriam had mentioned the digital forum on the women in leadership. It's some of those softer skills that are just as important in terms of running a lab and relating to workers and relating to people. So I think it's a nice balance there, and we're excited about both of them.
Awesome. And another thing I'd want to make sure that the guests can connect with you, connect with your platform, So give us some information how our listeners can learn more about how, maybe if they want to submit articles, if they want to make suggestions for articles, how can they connect with you and your platform?
So probably the easiest way is to go right online, which will be for today's clinical lab. The address is clinicallab.com. For G2 Intelligence, it's g2intelligence.com. You can definitely get in touch with us for our emails there, and both those sites will list out kind of our editorial guidelines. If you do want to submit or are interested in writing or contributing, you can read through there and see just some basic guidelines of what we expect and, you know, how we like stuff to be submitted to us. I don't know if you had anything to add to that, Miriam, since you deal with a lot with those submissions directly.
Yeah, you can reach out to us through our emails on the website, but we're also open on LinkedIn as well. So for those who prefer the more digital platform, you can send us over a message.
Well, thank you both for joining us today. This has been really informative. We have truly enjoyed the collab. I think as a podcast group and individuals that have worked with both of your platforms before, I would tell listeners, you know, I too thought, well, I've got nothing special to share. What can I say in a blog or an article? But definitely we all have value that we can bring to this community. So certainly reach out, share a message, share your thoughts about what you want to see from these platforms, what would be helpful for you and your community, whether you are working in industry or if you're working in research, if you're working in clinical, if you're working in a rural area, or if you're working in a large city, a licensed state versus an unlicensed state, etc. You know, tell them what you need to see, because it sounds like clearly they would like to continue to give us the content that's important to our profession. I want to thank our special guests, Scott and Miriam, for coming today. We really have appreciated talking to you, and we've learned a lot. I'm going to put all of this information about things you could look out for and ways to connect in our show notes. And hopefully we make a lot more connections here after this podcast. Make sure that you subscribe to our show and share it out. Elaborate Topics puts out new episodes every single week. We're listened to in over 100 countries. We've got over 180 episodes, quickly approaching 200 episodes in our fourth year of podcasting. And so myself and Lona and Taiwana really thank all of our valued listeners out there. We appreciate all of you. And until the next show, all of you have a great day.
Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Elaborate Topics, where your hosts discussed relevant strategies for laboratory professionals. Please subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast platform and listen to us on directimpactbroadcasting.com. Stay tuned for another episode with information you can use to excel in your laboratory career.